Man, ever since the election cycle, no one has really been talking about climate change anymore.
Yeah, that's probably because climate isn't even real.
Climate change most certainly is real. Have you been outside lately? It's only April and it's already like summer.
How can something that's not even real change?
Wait, you're saying you don't think climate is real? What?
That's correct. Climate is just a theory. It's not a real thing.
How? What? Of course there's a climate. We know for a fact that there was a different set of general weather conditions in the Pleistocene than there are today.
No, that's just weather. The weather is intelligently designed. It's not governed by some random uncontrolled process of climate.
But even if God makes it rain, there's still a climate.
No, there's microweather, but there's no such thing as macroweather or climate.
Okay, well, all the microweather of the Holocene epoch has shared characteristics, and all the microweather of the Pleistocene epoch has different shared characteristics.
Look, just because it was raining yesterday and it's raining today doesn't mean this is a rainy place. If you want to prove your climate theory, then show me the missing link between the Pleistocene weather and the Holocene weather. See? You can't.
But how do you explain that we had a land bridge in the Pleistocene, but none in the Holocene?
We just had warmer weather in the last 10,000 years. That doesn't mean that there's such a thing as climate that we can use to describe changes in microweather. Even the ice caps are going away now because the weather is warming up.
What the fuck? That's climate change!
No, it's just weather.
I give up. You're stupid. Jesus wasn't real. The Bible is just a book written by a bunch of guys. Christmas isn't Jesus' birthday, and Christianity is just a tool to control people.
Wow, you just sound completely unhinged. I'm out of here.
Hi, folks. That was part of a field recording I did where I would strike up conversations with total strangers. So it definitely happened, and you should be scared that people like this vote in my country. Anyway, Peter and I are back for an episode about space travel. We hope you like it. We'll start with NASA. You mentioned that climate funding has been eliminated.
Well, it hasn't been eliminated per se. I want to talk about the fact that NASA's budget has stayed the same while the climate research that they're doing is being slowly but surely defunded. And it has been slowly but surely reduced for a number of years now.
So they're just sort of reallocating the budget from climate to other stuff.
Pretty much.
Okay. But it's like exactly the same. So it's basically shrinking because of inflation.
Yeah, since 2010, everything has been up in the air.
Wow, thanks, Obama.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, hey everyone. Welcome to Well, Actually, where we're always right about absolutely everything.
Everything.
Everything. I'm Peter DeBeer, your regional correspondent in the Middle East.
I'm Ryan Salisbury, your regional correspondent in my basement.
Okay, today's topic is space colonization, and we wanted to talk about several aspects regarding space colonization, everything ranging from the current space industries all the way through to genetically engineering humans to live on Saturn.
Sounds good.
Excellent. So I wanted to start off, at first I wanted to start off talking about how back in 2009 NASA released plans for their first nuclear fission reactors that were supposed to be the size of trash cans. And I mean, this would have been a great stepping stone in the race for space colonialism, but that's pretty much been scrapped more recently in exchange for supporting the push for private companies to take over the space race. And this has been highlighted very strongly by stuff like Trump's signing of his latest NASA bill last month, where the NASA's budget stayed pretty much the same, and most of it was now being As far as I know, the authorization bill mandated that NASA can't acquire space flight services from foreign entities unless there are no NASA vehicles or U.S. commercial providers available.
I'm telling you, folks, it's going to be great.
It's going to be fantastic. I mean, if you take into account that of the 115 space-related companies started in the past decade and backed by investors, 84 of them have been focused on satellites. According to the Tari Group, they track space investment, in the last year alone, those companies launched 100 microsatellites, which is up from 25 microsatellites launched in 2011. So if we extrapolate that out, we get to 2,400 nano and microsatellites, which will be launched between 2017 and 2023.
So do you know like what most of these like micro and nano satellites are for? Like I know there's like satellite radio and satellite TV and shit, but like what else is there besides that stuff?
In all honesty, the majority of them that I've managed to track, and look, I didn't go through all 100 launched in last year.
Oh, why not?
and I also didn't look at the plans for the 2,400 in the coming years. But from what I can tell, most of them are pretty frivolous crap.
Okay.
Yeah, like you said, we're talking about satellite TV, we're talking about satellite radio, we're talking about networks that are supposed to be setting up for an outernet, whatever.
Oh yeah, the planetary wide internet.
Which actually turns out to be a really bad idea because it's going to cause more space junk, which is going to cause more collisions in orbit, which is going to create even more space junk, which is going to cause more collisions. And there's a lot of space agencies that are really unhappy about all these microsatellites being launched. So, yeah.
I mean, that's the price you pay to get on Facebook.
Exactly.
Sorry, guys. Sorry.
You want to be on Facebook? You're going to be creating movies like Gravity.
Oh, yeah. Why didn't I think of Spacebook? Damn.
Yeah, and let's not forget that the really big aerospace companies tend to be heavily involved in defense contracts, and that the current geopolitical landscape will also impact the aerospace industry.
Right, so I know like a little bit. I took a few notes on this particular subject. You know, there's currently a treaty that almost every nation in the world has signed and ratified called the Outer Space Treaty.
Yeah.
It has a really ridiculously long name that I'm not going to bother saying here, but it's basically called the Outer Space Treaty, and it forbids, among other things, having weapons of mass destruction in space, having, I think, like any sort of military craft, like manned craft meant for the military in space, and we'll get back to this later, but it also forbids any government from claiming a celestial resource, so that like the moon or any other celestial bodies are not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty or any other means. And so I don't know, I kind of think it's only a matter of time before we're back to space lasers, personally. Like back in the 80s with, was it Reagan?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not just about being able to get weapons into space. You know, as the U.S. intensifies its involvement in the Middle East and cross-continent conflicts and so on, defense spending is almost guaranteed to rise. And if we take into account the fact that the U.S. already has a military budget bigger than the rest of the world put together, we start to see that any increase in that, it's going to benefit the aerospace companies.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, almost every emerging economy is also looking to increase their defense spending. So, despite all the global trade risks, the aerospace and defense industry is expected to benefit from these kinds of tense scenarios globally.
I mean, they have to keep growing. Like, they're not going to be like, okay, well, we're getting enough money now. That's fine. Yeah, you know, a couple trillion a year. That's enough. They're going to keep growing, so they're going to have to figure out ways to, like, keep making more stuff and putting it in more places.
I was actually, and as part of the research for the show, I was looking at the current space programs globally and the aerospace industries, they're looking at growing everything. And at the moment, they're looking at growing it to 1.5 trillion necessary to justify the 3% historical growth rate of capitalism as we know it. So, I mean, the industry won't be any exception.
Well, freedom isn't free.
Yeah, it's becoming harder and harder to justify that kind of capitalization of resources on the planet. And so we come to our topic of the day and how it's necessary for capitalists to venture out into space with their glorious capital in order to keep justifying their own existence.
But the way I've always put it is, before we were interested in space exploration, and now we're interested in space exploitation.
That is a very good way to put it. A big focus in recent years has been the space tourism nonsense. And I'm sorry for being so blunt about it, but it is nonsense. At the end of the day, the only people that are going to be able to afford to tour into space are your
Silicon Valley dorks.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, if we had to go and figure out what is the benefit to society at large from sending a billionaire idiot into space so that he can drink martinis in zero G.
Well, the benefit would be if it was a one-way ticket.
It would be, but it's space tourism, so their return is kind of implied.
Well, accidents happen.
Accidents do happen, and we can only hope.
I mean, I personally would love to go into space in, you know, just to see it. I think it'd be really cool, but since I'll never be able to afford it, I'm not going to fight for it.
Exactly. And I mean,
if it doesn't affect me, I don't care.
I find it insane that space tourism is pushed as a global industry when regular tourism is already unattainable for more than half the planet. Yeah, it's a bit ridiculous.
Well, see, Peter, you don't get it, because the way capitalism works, okay, it lowers costs. So, like, sure, today it's only going to be rich people that can do it. But, you know, 10, 20, 30 years from now, it's also going to be upper middle class people that can do it.
I'm not sure if you exactly understand how capitalism works, because capitalism is not pro having even an upper middle class. The upper middle class is either part of the ruling class or they're not. So yeah, I we're going to be at odds here.
Yeah, so another interesting article that you linked in this discussion, which I've actually thought about before myself, is that capitalism isn't really compatible with space exploration. I don't even know if they put it that way, space exploration specifically, but I mean, capital is very risk averse. The value of capital is based on the expected future value of the capital over time, adjusted for risk. So the more risk there is, the less valuable capital is in the present. And that's why capitalist businesses don't take big risks like developing nuclear reactors or making original movies that aren't based on anime.
Look, space is probably the riskiest industry out there. Your chances of even a successful mission, I mean, how many attempts did the Falcon, SpaceX's Falcon rocket have before it finally managed to land? I think it was on like attempt number 7 or something that they finally managed to land again. And by that time, they'd spent how many billions?
Yeah, this is like the pet project of a billionaire. It's not like business that, you know, like tons of investors are like baying at the door to get in on. It's just like, oh, what do I do with all my money? Maybe I'll go into space.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I feel a bit sorry for Elon Musk with his... No, I feel so bad for him. If I think about all the new private jets and the new Maseratis and the new mansions he's going to have to forego in order to build another Falcon X, I mean, how is he supposed to increase his portfolio?
Yeah, tough road ahead. Maybe he should just crush them into metal and then use that to directly make the rockets. they're probably made from aerospace metal anyway.
Yeah, no, I definitely
those
agree.
Fancy cars.
Okay, I think today we've got a really good ad that was put forward by a company for us to play on our
Mac. Yeah, we're officially sponsored now.
Officially sponsored. So yeah, I think let's play that now and let's see how much our audience loves it. Now, I think they're going to love it just as much as we do.
Yeah, me too. Is your new fashion line not selling as well as expected? Send it to us, Grand Nagus Marketing, and we will fly it into space, add our official space branding to it, and turn it into space fashion. Did your competitor's new mobile device beat you in specs? Who needs great specs when you have the allure of owning an item that comes from the stars? We will repackage all your phones, and instead of a low-status Made in China sticker, you'll get the luxurious and exclusive Made in Space recognition.
Is your abattoir struggling? Rebrand yourself with pure, delicious space bacon.
And now, for only $1 million per unit, we will even rebrand automobiles for the luxury space car market.
Has the global bicycle market been saturated and your company is stuck in a rut? No problem. Just outsource your labeling to us for that hyperspace zero-G bicycle that is guaranteed to have people throwing their money at you.
We are currently partnering with Planetary Resources to include asteroid metals in your products, thereby increasing their value.
Our smelting partners even work in orbit around the sun in order to achieve hyperdense alloys.
The only thing cooler than space is lasers, and the only thing cooler than that is space lasers. Our branding is all done using space lasers, the coolest possible way to accomplish anything.
As 21st century job creators, our $4 billion a year company employs anywhere up to 7 billion people.
We care about social justice. That's why we hold ourselves to a strict set of rules concerning acquisition. Like rule number 239, never be afraid to mislabel a product.
Or rule number 452, we don't just appropriate brand cultures, we reimagine them. Okay, now after that great advertisement brought to you by Orbital Systems, or what was it?
Grand Nagus Marketing. You gotta learn the name of our sponsors, man.
sorry, Grand Nagus. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to talk about today was how instead of having a global space race happening and the nation states being the ones that are the driving force behind the space tech innovations.
By the way, the USSR won.
Yes, they totally did. Do you know why? Because they're still at it.
And because they got to every goal that actually matters. We got to the place that no one cares about.
Exactly. Part of the new NASA mission to get to Mars in the 2030s is going to be using the moon as a stopover. And as part of that, they're looking at employing the trash can fission nuclear reactors. And as part of that, they're hoping that they can mine helium-3 on the moon. All of which is a really stupid idea. But
yeah, why would you power your spaceship with a trash can?
Exactly.
I've never gotten a trash can to do anything useful like that.
Although, let's admit, Doc Brown managed to power the DeLorean using a trash can. So obviously this is exactly...
That's true. Everything else from Back to the Future came true, so like, we gotta have the trash can.
Yeah, definitely. It's good to see NASA using very original sources for their for their ideas.
Yeah, we've tried using scientific journals for our research, but we've never tried movies, and I think that's an approach to innovation that will take us into the 21st century.
Could these fuckers start, like, looking at all the technological applications that have already come out of the Star Trek franchise?
Yeah.
Anyway.
We need a warp drive.
So now, instead of having these big nation states doing all the driving behind this highly risky industry, we're now starting to see everything being sort of channeled towards private enterprise. And you've got your companies that are offering space tourism. You've got several companies that are now proposing to mine asteroids, which really helps since the NASA asteroid redirection program has been cancelled. They're no longer going after asteroids anymore. And this opens yet another avenue for private enterprise to step in and take over capitalism for the win.
And really, we're not exploiting enough raw materials yet. Only like 5% of my garbage is metal, so we need to raise that to at least 25% for capitalism to keep going.
Exactly. So then you've got industry companies like DSI, who I think it was back in 2012 when they came out and told everyone about their plans to mine asteroids, and these asteroids are going to give us valuable minerals and everything that is going to really help us to get off of the exploitation of Earth, never mind whether or not these asteroid mining ventures go against the Outer Space Treaty. And then you've got countries like Luxembourg, who are very secretive. We had a little discussion about their secrecy, and I went looking, and I couldn't find anything.
Yeah, you can't find anywhere their money is going. Like, obviously, they're not going to tell anyone, but other countries won't. They don't mention it either, even though they're the second biggest investor in the world besides the U.S. And the only investment we know about is this asteroid mining shit.
They're also one of the world's leading tax havens. They're also one of the leading areas for financial capital being consolidated and redirected. And they've got a very interesting capitalist system going there, man. Very interesting indeed.
Oh, and they have one of the highest perceived corruption indexes anywhere in the world. And
yeah.
It's a nice country. It's not a place with like warlords and stuff.
Exactly. It's so freaking, like, I was so lost while looking for stuff on Luxembourg, because everything about them, when you Google them, when you Wikipedia them, everything is just this like, oh, look at this place of sunshine and rainbows and wonderfulness.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, you literally cannot find out anything about what they're doing with their money.
I'm going to assume that it's just like they invest in companies that build drones that drown Iraqi babies.
That would be the most obvious assumption, I think. The other area that we do know that they're funding at the moment is asteroid mining. And they have funded both sides of the current battle for asteroids.
Space race profiteering, huh?
Yeah. They've funded Planetary Resources, which is a multinational company based in the U.S. They've also funded DCI, also a multinational company in the U.S. And both of these companies are aiming to go. They've got rockets being built. They're going out into space, and they're going to mine rockets. DCI has come under a lot of scrutiny because of their proposals, and it was pointed out to them that they can't, like, there's no guarantee that they're going to be getting any precious minerals off an asteroid. And then they turned around and said, no, well, we're not going for precious minerals, we're going for water. Water will be our main thing. And then it was pointed out to them that, well, look, building the capsules and stuff you'll need to get that water back to the surface of the Earth is definitely not going to be worth the effort.
They just need a pipeline.
Yeah, so then what they did is they changed everything, and they were like, no, well, we're not actually going to send it back down to Earth. We're actually going to mine the water for use in space to put out those fires that NASA is currently looking into. I don't know if anyone else saw this.
Yeah, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, so last week, or was it this week? Very recently, NASA, as part of a series of tests they're doing, because of all this rise in space colonization industry, they're looking at different materials and how to contain fires in space. And one of the tests that they did was they had a module on the International Space Station that was due to be decommissioned, and it would detach and fall back into the Earth's atmosphere, burning up on its way down. And so before burning up and being wasted and gone forever, they decided to install a whole bunch of sensors inside and then start a fire right after ejecting it. And that way they can look at how fire spreads in zero gravity and what happens. And so it's been very interesting. I read several articles on that. But now we know that this vital resource of water, which on our planet's surface is turning to crap and running out, and we're screwing with the hydrocycle everywhere we go and everything. They're going to go and mine water so they can put out fires in space and feed astronauts.
Fires in space happen like all the time, right?
All the time. It's like 15 okay. times a day. That's how astronauts do marshmallows.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So.
Exactly.
Sounds reasonable. You got to put the fire out somehow. They don't have much dirt up in space. It's very clean up there.
Indeed. So. Yeah, so in looking at all these private enterprises, what really stood out to me is obviously SpaceX is one of the most spoken about companies on the planet at the moment, with their Falcon X rockets and their successful re-landing of a rocket ship, which then can be relaunched and re-landed, and basically they're recycling rocket ships and they're doing their bit for the environment, you know. What I found interesting was that there is an actual competitor against Musk and it is the great, wonderful, and benevolent Jeff Bezos. So Amazon, who we really should discuss in one of our upcoming episodes.
We'll do one on Walmart and Amazon.
That'll be interesting. Amazon, the company famous for not turning a profit while still turning a profit, is going into space, and they are the... It is not Amazon, actually. It is... What is this company called?
Oh, I have no idea.
Blue Origin. Sorry, Blue Origin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's SpaceX versus Blue Origin, and it's DSI versus Planetary Resources. And what we're seeing is the privatization of the space race. Now, given how things went with the arms race in the Cold War, how do you think the space race now is likely to pan out?
Well, I think that, Blue Origin, probably not a strong contender at the moment, but, you know, there's always a chance of a come-from-behind victory. I don't know.
Yeah, basically what we're going to see is we're eventually going to see either a merger or an acquisition or a failure or, you know, everything that happens with capitalism. And
we should do like a mergers acquisitions bracket, like tournament bracket.
That would be awesome. Do it gladiatorial style. I don't think we should focus too much more attention on talking about our capitalist overlords and their near-orbit space exploration.
Yeah, snooze.
Snooze fest galore.
All right, so you want to get to deep space travel?
I really do. This is where things get really interesting, because right now we're going into the realm of science fiction.
Yeah, well, and science fact, because I'm always interested in the realism of doing something that people kind of dream about. So the most obvious one is the health issues of space travel. We already know that astronauts lose bone and muscle density when they're in space.
Yep.
Most people think that the solution to that is artificial gravity. So like spinning a cylinder around the axis of whatever craft you're in to create, you know, centrifugal force that simulates gravity.
Yeah.
But space agencies have found that exercise is actually sufficient. So, like, cosmonauts have talked about long-term missions actually being much easier to recover from than short ones, because the exercise regimes that they're on are a lot stricter on the longer-term missions. So, like, one of them even said he went on a 340-day mission and then the next day swam a kilometer, no problem.
That's actually quite interesting. I'm curious to know if the exercise regimes had any kind of effect on the phenomenon of visual impairment in intracranial pressure syndrome.
So that's actually my next note. Vision loss is not helped by exercise. There's speculation that it could be helped by artificial gravity, but since no one knows what the actual cause is, it's not certain. It could be, there's speculation that it could be due to elevated carbon dioxide levels, but basically the cause is just unknown.
Okay, so I also did a little bit of research on the VIP syndrome, and I found that back in, I think it was September of last year, what's his name? I think it's Noam Alperin, who's a professor of radiology and biomedical engineering at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. He did an extensive study, and he found that cerebrospinal fluid, which is the clear liquid that floats under the brain and spine, and which helps to deliver nutrients and remove waste products, and it cushions the nervous system from harm. On Earth, the fluid easily redistributes itself to accommodate changes in pressure and posture, and we can stand up, we can walk around, bend over, and all that without worrying about hurting our heads. But he found that in space, the CSF was much less able to adjust to microgravity, which is basically saying that intracranial pressure is now pushing on the back of the eye and causing these ridges and these problems with the eye. So there's a very good chance that there's no solution, and that anyone who decides to go for long-term space travel is likely to go blind in the long term.
So you're saying that they're getting space glaucoma? Because if so, I know how to cure that.
Oh, yeah, we can totally toke out on that one.
I mean, I don't know how many weed dealers there are in space, but I'm sure that if you go into any space parking lot, you'll be able to find some herb.
And you will get spaced. Sorry, that was my bad pun for the day.
First one ever. First one ever today in the recording. First bad pun. Woo-hoo! First and last one.
Yeah, the rest of them were all brilliant and no one even noticed.
Oh, so there's one more thing about artificial gravity. The usual depiction of artificial gravity is the cylinder spinning around the axis of travel. So it's spinning axially. I'm currently waving my hand in the direction that I'm talking about, but no one can see that. So if you don't know what axial means, go Google axial. You'll understand. There's a problem with that, which is the Coriolis effect. Evidently, the Coriolis effect from this artificial gravity concept can actually induce nausea, quite uncomfortable. But there's an alternative. There's an alternative to it. And this is really weird to think about, but it uses two craft, or a craft of the counterweight, tied together with a tether, spinning radially around the axis of travel. So it flies like a frisbee, basically. And that doesn't have the same nausea-inducing effect.
Now, that's interesting. Do you think that's what they use on board the Enterprise?
They probably use tachyons.
Ah, you see, we really need to up our game on this, on the R&D.
Yeah, we need tachyons. Or Minkowski particles, one of the two.
Damn. Okay. Okay, the way I see it, When we're discussing the colonization of other celestial bodies, there's one of three options. Either because we now know that other planets in our solar system are definitely not habitable, we have three options available to us. Either we terraform these planets or celestial bodies, like the Moon or Mars, or How Jupiter would be terraformed is completely beyond me. And there are plans in place, theoretical plans in place on how to terraform a planet like Mars. But the technology is beyond us at this point in time, and it is not looking likely to become available at any time in the near future.
I mean, if we can get that, we should use it to stop climate change first.
You'd kind of think that would be the main focus, but no, let's talk about colonizing Mars.
Just in case climate change fucks us over and we all die, we need to have a lifeboat.
To a planet that's already dead and that we can resuscitate.
Yeah.
So the second option, and as you pointed out, it's far more likely, is genetically engineering people to survive on these new environments. Obviously, something like...
In other words, space marines.
There we go. There we go. Or space mutants, if we want to link up to our last podcast.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know much either, but I don't know if you know much about Warhammer 40K. There's, you know, a race in that called the Space Marines, and they actually have been bioengineered to survive in space and to survive, like, extreme combat. So they have, like, extra organs and, like, specialized organs that let them breathe in space and stuff like that. So, same kind of
thing. I'm sorry, did you say breathe in space?
I don't know if they put it that way. That's just the easy way that I'm putting it.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Not suffocate in space. Let's put it that way.
Okay, fair enough. Because, breathing in the vacuum of space.
Well, technically, it's not a vacuum. There's an interstellar medium. Maybe they have like a giant, you know, miles wide scoop that, as long as they keep moving through the interstellar medium, it compresses enough gas to let them respirate.
I'm sorry. Did I just assume their species? Yeah, so that obviously is, with current technology, it is possible that would be the most likely alternative that the human race would consider when colonizing other planets that are not currently inhabited. We're not talking about your Avatar or...
Talking about CRISPR.
Yeah, pretty much. And then the most likely and also probably the most expensive route would be to set up biodome-type colonies wherever we go so that we create an artificial environment in which human beings can live. But, as Pauly Shore showed us back in the day, that's probably not the best idea.
Buddy. I mean, I think there's a fourth option, which is... It's sort of just like a space station that we ship resources to constantly. That's also possible.
Yeah, look.
Not desirable, but...
Yeah, the thing is that right now, the way things are set up, we have to assume that the only people that are going to make it off this planet alive at the current rate of everything by the year 2100 are going to be your wealthy elite capitalists, your political elite... And because there aren't really all that many of them, we're basically talking about dedicating an entire planet's worth of resources to protecting these elite douchebags as they colonize.
My personal prediction is that in the year 2100, Mars will be inhabited by the immortal Elon Musk and his best friend Wilson, the volleyball.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, well, look, obviously, for most of the show, we've been very focused on the U.S. and the U.S. space programs and private industries and everything.
I mean, no one else is going to make it, so...
Well, this is the interesting bit, is there are several other programs around the planet that are not American. So, fuck you, America. as we've already mentioned, Luxembourg is serious about mining asteroids, and they're partnering up with several companies in order to get water to those space fires. The European Space Agency, the ESA, are planning to take part in the Russian lunar program because Russia wants to go to the moon too. You know, they feel a bit jealous that the US did it. And Putin wants to be putting some astronauts, some cosmonauts on the moon.
Are they going
to
wear shirts?
Oh, sorry. Please explain that reference to those of our listeners who don't get it.
just go to Google Images and type in Vladimir Putin and then hit enter and you'll get the joke.
Okay. Moving on. Not many people seem to be aware that China is pushing forward on a number of space fronts, including making robotic missions to the moon.
Yeah, I had no idea about this.
Yeah. China has been automating their space program for quite a while now. And they're making very quick progress given the amount of time they've actually spent in space and how long their space program's been going in comparison with nations like Russia and the US. And
I'm sure that when other people talk about the success of the Chinese in getting into space, they're going to say it's because of capitalism.
Yeah, of course, because
anything bad that happens in China is because of communism, see? And anything good that happens is because of capitalism. That's how it works.
Exactly. It's thanks to capitalism that Mars is touted as their 2030 mission, where they intend to return with samples, not just send rovers there that get stuck in ditches. They're also in the process of drafting policy on commercial space exploration. So, go capitalism!
Yeah.
India, on the other hand, is going in the other direction. They want to go to Venus by, I think their program said something like 2025, sometime after 2020.
So they're also trying to escape global warming by going to Venus.
Exactly.
They're like, oh my god, our streets are melting. Time to go somewhere nicer. Let's go to Venus.
Venus. And it's perfect because it's got the same amount of pollution. Also, I was reading recently about how Australia wants their own space agency, but let's face it, they'll probably just turn it into a really good cooking show.
And you can't launch rockets upside down. It's not going to work. Sorry, Australia.
And one of my favorite little tidbits is that thanks to Brexit and national populism, the UK will likely be excluded from future EU space projects.
Which means that space is safe from bad food and passive-aggressive nonsense.
So, look, space is a big deal to most of the planet, and we obviously have dreams of getting out there, and those dreams have fueled a lot of stories throughout our history. Tales of traveling to the stars have abounded in our fiction for a very long time. From the ancient Greeks all the way through till now, we've got more and more space-based movies. If you go do a quick search on Wikipedia for a list on the movies entailing Mars inhabitation, and it's insane how much money has been invested in telling the stories of space colonization.
And if we had invested all that money into actually getting there, we probably could have just all gone.
Yeah. If we'd spent all the money Hollywood spent telling the stories on space exploration, we would probably have our space elevator by now.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, Japan is doing. They've recently acquired several graphene-based technologies, and they're finally ready to start putting together their plan for a space elevator, and we should see plans for that being published in the near future.
So, 2100, Principality of Xeon, do you think it's going to happen?
I'm not so sure. I don't think the commercial applications for graphene are that extensive yet, but you never know. The Japanese have done some amazing things, including what's that warrior show they do?
Oh, Ninja Warrior? Oh, that show
rules.
Yeah,
man. Exactly. Like, if they can make Ninja Warrior, space elevators are nothing, man.
Yeah, of course. There's something we skipped over with the actual, like, practical aspects of deep space travel, which is food. So, I mean, currently, any astronaut has to get food, like, shipped to them. Like, they have to fly it up to the space station or whatever, or they have to carry it with them. So it's kind of hard to go on a long journey if you have to either keep all of your supplies or receive continuous supply shipments from Earth.
Definitely.
But we're actually still a very long way from even being able to think about self-sufficiency of food in space. So there's been experiments to grow crops in space. We are currently growing lettuce on the International Space Station. And there's been a few other food crops that have been grown, like peas and I think broccoli and some other stuff like that. But you can't really feed yourself on lettuce. It's a good supplement for their diet. It's great that they're doing it, you know, and they get some fresh food. So I'm sure that it's, you know, kind of an enjoyment thing too. But it's not a staple food. And the big problem is staple foods here on Earth are fine because we have plenty of space. We don't have to worry about the weight of stuff that we use. But in space, you can't really haul milling and hauling equipment up into space onto your spacecraft because they're really heavy, first of all. And also, they produce waste that have to be dealt with. So, like, not only are you weighing your craft down with crops that have extra stuff on it that you're not even going to eat, but you have to have all this specialized equipment to process the food. And then the other problem is, especially for plant-only system, you need to supply nutrients to it. So even if you're not carrying food up with you, you still have to carry nutrients up there.
Sorry, all I can picture now is NASA trying to install an aquaponic system with fish.
That's the next point. On Earth, if you want to create a cropping system that recycles its nutrients, you use aquaponics, which is you have a hydroponics bed, which grows plants, and then you take the wastewater from the hydroponic system, pump it into a fish tank, and the fish, well, they put some plants in there, like duckweed, which grows really fast, or something similar to that. And so the fish eat those plants and the other nutrients from the wastewater, and then they pee and poop in the water, and that gets cycled back to the plants, which then can feed off of that. So it's a continuous cycle.
Essentially a closed system.
Right, right. The problem is fish do very poorly in space. So I mentioned earlier the bone and muscle density loss of humans. That starts after, I think, 6 to 7 days in space, something like that. Fish start losing bones and muscle almost immediately upon getting into a microgravity environment, and it's greatly accelerated compared to humans. So they've actually been used as subjects of studies of the effects of microgravity on the body. They use this particular species of fish that is completely transparent, so they can actually like watch it waste away in space. But the point is, aquaponics is not really realistic in space without solving this bone and density loss issue.
Okay, so even if they were to set up a giant space station midway between the moon and the Earth and have it rotate to create microgravity, it's unlikely to solve the problem.
Yeah, I don't know if they've figured out whether or not the artificial gravity solution will help fish. There's speculation that it might have to do with the water pressure, which I guess also has to do with gravity, but like, you know, fish are used to having a certain amount of water pressure, which is a lot less in space.
Yeah, no, and I'm not going to lie, having watched multiple videos on the whole fire thing in space, it turns out that water is just as difficult to manipulate in low gravity, microgravity, and zero gravity as fire is. Obviously not quite as dangerous, but as it separates in your compartment, because it's not being held down by gravity properly and the flow dynamics change and everything, it becomes very, very dangerous. What I'm trying to remember what the movie was that I watched recently that had the one with Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt.
Passengers.
And there was a scene
bad.
In the movie. I enjoyed the movie, but that's because I went to go watch it with my wife, and it was kind of it was a mix of romance for her and fun space stuff for me. And one of the scenes in the movie has her going for a swim on board this giant ship that is being sent to colonize another another place, and suddenly the gravity switches off. and this entire swimming pool that she's now gotten out of starts floating around. And because she is unable to move properly in zero gravity, there's no way to get away from the water. So she starts drowning in midair in water. And this is a legit problem that's been looked at by NASA extensively, and they don't have a solution.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay, so one other point to you bringing up the problem of nutrition. Unrelated to my searches for today's program, this morning I was reading an article about how one of the biggest issues facing society today is healthy soil, and how that's really the key to feeding the world. And in the article, and this was on theconversation.com, one of the points that they brought up is that at the moment, there's never more than really about a year's worth of food available for the global population based on the current agricultural systems and the way that everything's going. So if we can't even support ourselves for longer than a year, if everything went to hell in a handbasket tomorrow, we'd have a year. And if we can't outlast a year on a planet that has full functioning ecosystems for the most part,
billions of years old,
billions of years old that's lasted that long, how the hell are we going to do it in space?
Yeah.
For what could be a 30 or 40 year journey to the nearest habitable planet, because we don't have a clue how to terraform the planets nearest us. We don't really know what the outcome is going to be if we genetically engineer a human to go live on one of those planets, and the biodomes to inhabit those planets would be exorbitantly expensive to design. We're left with, oh, let's magically create a warp drive that can take us to star 34 light years away, and it'll take us a journey of 15 to 30 years to get there. How do we survive?
We're going to get into a war with the Romulans.
Exactly. Because let's face it, we're going to end up taking over space for something that's already inhabited. Okay, yeah. So because of this heavy focus on space exploration in our sci-fi genres in storytelling for a long time, one of my favorite books as a kid, a series of books, was Pierce Anthony's Bio of a Space Tyrant. At that time that I read it, it was a 5-book series. A 6th book has been written since then, covering the same story, but from a slightly different angle. So, yeah, I just want to take 5 minutes quickly and just quickly talk about it, because I feel like it's one of the most realistic looks at how space colonization in our solar system is likely to play out.
Okay.
Now, so the premise is simple. Humans have managed to figure out how to manipulate gravity through the use of electromagnetic lenses, which enables us to leave the surface of the Earth and travel through space using minimal fuel, meaning that colonization of the solar system has become relatively simple. Now, gravity lensing doesn't allow us to accelerate to the speed of light or break the light barrier. It doesn't allow us to travel through wormholes or anything like that, so we're still stuck basically in the solar system. But the solar system's a pretty big place, so as the humans expand out into space, we are faced with new challenges, and for a couple of hundred years, there is peace and cooperation amongst humanity.
Oh, so this is like a few centuries into the future?
Yeah, yeah. It's taken, I mean, obviously it takes a while to set up a space colony and to get it to the strength of a planetary state. Which is where he ends up going with this. So they use the same technology to create bubble cities on various planets throughout, on all of the planets throughout the solar system, including most of the moons. And many of the situations in the series are direct parallels to situations here on Earth. Now, obviously, we have to keep in mind that the series would have been based on the geopolitics of the 1970s and 80s, but not that much has changed since then. There have been obviously some major changes, fall of the Berlin Wall, so on and so forth, the end of apartheid, there have been major changes, but at the same time, when you look at it as a pair of aliens looking down on Earth, not that much has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, we've colonized all the planets, but those planets are still kind of set up in the same way that we now see the Earth separated into nation states. You now see the solar system set up into planetary states. So, like, Mercury belongs to South Africa, Venus belongs to North Africa. Earth, interestingly enough, is taken over by India, and the Moon is taken over by Sri Lanka. The Middle East moves into Mars. Phobos and Deimos, the moons of Mars, are taken over by Israel and Palestine, the West Bank, you know. So that conflict continues. Then you've got stuff like Hawaii and Cyprus being represented in the asteroid belt on bodies like Hidalgo and Chiron. You've got Jupiter, which is taken over by basically North and Central America, with the Great Red Spot being represented by Mexico. Then you can go further, and I mean, you've got the outer moons and the moons of Jupiter kind of representing the West Indies. So you've got Puerto Rico, you've got Cuba, you've got the Lesser Antilles. All of that is represented in the moons of Jupiter. Then you go over to Saturn, which is represented by what was then the Soviet Union, kind of. And you've got northern Saturn is the Soviet Union, and southern Saturn is China. And so you've got all of these nations represented throughout the solar system. Interestingly enough, Pluto is Antarctica.
So wait, which one is Africa?
Africa is taken over. They take over Venus and Mercury.
Oh, they get the worst planets.
Oh, of course they do. It's Africa. Africa always gets the worst of everything. Yeah, so the main character is Hope Hubris, and a lot of the story also follows his sister Spirit Hubris. I've always loved the names because I think it's a very interesting play on the character himself and the hubris that he has throughout the books, and while maintaining quite a large amount of hope. And it wasn't the best naming conventions ever, but it worked for the book. Yeah. And so the books really do look at a lot of political conflict as we understand it geopolitically today and back in the 1980s. And you can see it in situations like, at one point, Hope is in the military and he's stationed on Chiron, which is an analog of Cyprus, like I said. And in order to keep the peace between the colonists of Greece and the colonists of Turkey, there's a whole story that happens there. Also, in the first book, his family tries to leave the Jupiter moon Callisto, and it's very analogous to the Latinos trying to enter the United States today. It even includes like Hope's inability to find work as anything other than a poorly paid agricultural worker on Jupiter. Later on, you get to see that Mars is controlled by countries formerly comprising the Middle East, like I mentioned, and In this universe that Pierce Anthony creates, Mars is the largest source of iron in the solar system. And that becomes the primary fuel in this fictional universe because you need iron to build the bubble cities and the spaceships and everything. Even though the fuel to manipulate gravity isn't, like, it's negligent, you still need to build the actual ships and stuff. So iron becomes the primary fuel. I mean, I think there was even a missile crisis in one of the...
Yeah, I think you mentioned that.
Yeah. Okay, so I think instead of giving you a plot summary of the books and everything, I brought this up because I think it's important to note how fiction, and obviously for this topic, very specifically science fiction, is a means for us to talk about geopolitical issues without directly touching on the issues, without offending people that are heavily invested in one side of the debate, you know, without offending cultural sects. We're able to discuss these topics through fiction and
without people bringing up white genocide.
Exactly. God, as a South African, if I can only tell you how often I've heard those words.
I bet they sound better with your accent.
Much worse, actually.
So that's a good segue into the last point that I would like to talk about, which is the ethics of colonizing space. As a leftist, I do have a bit of a problem with the term space colonization. See, one of the main jobs of leftists is to police all language. We have to question every single word that everyone uses. It's the most important political front is changing language.
That being said, I should point out the fact that while you said earlier it should be more accurately termed space exploitation, I think mm-hmm. that what we're planning and the way things are panning out right now is it's probably going to end up more as space colonialism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't have a problem with humans expanding into space, kind of moving out, spreading our species reach out to the stars. But colonialism colonization seems like a really fascist way to think about it. It's kind of, putting humans at the center of everything and just assuming that wherever we go in space is going to be ours, or, whatever is already there doesn't matter. So the main ethical question of colonizing another planet is, what if there's life there and we wipe it out? Or what if there's the potential for life and we disrupt it?
We didn't really care when we, and by we, I mean us European white,
right.
The civilized world decided to go and get some resources from South America, Central America, the Far East, Africa, all of it, really.
And it all began the way that we're beginning our new journey into space, which is, private industry basically trying to consolidate power by getting resources from places that, they don't have they haven't expanded their reach into.
Have they developed a flag to put on the asteroids that are going to be mined?
I don't know.
Because we all know that's how you colonize.
Right, right. Yeah, you go, you plant your flag, and then everybody's like, well, he called dibs.
Exactly.
Finders keepers. So, yeah, I don't think we should be space colonizers. I think we should, as a united humanity, expand our realm into the parts of space that are ethical for us to expand into.
Yeah. I don't think there's been enough debate on the ethics of space colonization. I think there's been a general assumption by those that are planning to do the colonizing that it's just all good, that mm-hmm. they'll cross that bridge when they get to it. But this is not the kind of thing that we should be so blasé about. I think that there needs to be an international dialogue surrounding the future of space colonization and how it can be done in such a way that doesn't marginalize the dominant portion of the planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, that this also goes back to the whole lifeboat ethics thing of, when rich people are done destroying the planet for their personal power, they're also going to be the only ones allowed to go to the safe extraterrestrial settlements, which they will probably also ruin.
Exactly. I had, back in my days of running the lunchroom debate group, I had a long debate the one day about what the minimum requirements were. If in a hypothetical situation, the Earth's about to fail, the whole planet pulls together and they decide to dedicate all the global resources to saving as much of the planet as possible by putting it all on a giant spaceship and sending it to another planet with new technologies and. It turns out that you only need about 50 human beings in order to start a new colony. And the reason for the 50 is you need genetic diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Anything less than that and you're probably looking at way too much inbreeding.
Mm-hmm.
And which is detrimental to the long-term prospects. But this would also be true for every animal that we're able to save and every plant species that we try to save. You can't just take one fern and go, ooh, look at me, I saved a fern.
You need two. That's what we learn from the Bible.
Yeah,
greatest teacher of knowledge.
So there's more ethical debate necessary. It is paramount necessary
I mean, hopefully we don't destroy the planet and kill everyone. I think that's right. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not an ethicist. I'm not an expert. But I think we should not kill everyone.
Yeah, look, I think you're being utopian and a clear leftist.
I'm being deontologist.
I'm not gonna go there. But I think one of the big things that is being ignored in all of this is that before we can get to a point where we can fix the planet as a whole, where we can spread humanity as a whole into the rest of the cosmos, is fixing our own planet. You know, if we're incapable of that, if we're incapable of reaching peaceful relations with our neighbors, if we're incapable of getting past exploitative economic doctrines and political doctrines, then what's the point of spreading? What is it then that we are spreading?
The primitivists will be proven right. Humanity will be a virus on the planet and on other planets. And we don't want to prove them right. They're terrible.
Yeah, look, I've never agreed with the primitivists on almost anything. You know this about me. I know that you have more sympathy for them than I do.
I'm not diabetic.
Yeah.
And I don't wear glasses either.
I only wear glasses sometimes, okay?
Okay.
But more than that, I think that one of my biggest disagreements with groups like Deep Green Resistance is that I don't view humanity as a parasite. I don't view us as a cancer on this planet. If we were to follow their proper Gaia theory for their spiritual side of things and assume that the entire planet is one big living organism, then we're not a cancer, we're not a parasite, we're not some external threat to the planet. We're an internal threat. We're an autoimmune disease. And while these are not curable, they are treatable, they are manageable. We are able to deal with them by taking systemic measures, by planning things properly, by investigating, by working towards a solution, which is something that unfortunately in a lot of today's discourse goes completely missing.
Yeah, you need to take your 50 milligrams of anarchism a day.
Exactly. Okay, yeah, so I think that's my bit for the day.
Okay, I have one more thing, and this will be glommed on to the end of the book you were talking about.
Okay.
So this kind of ties into ethics. I'm not going to go too deep into it because basically it's about Gundam. And so the original Gundam series is about basically space Nazis.
Yeah.
There's this guy named Zeon Zum Daikun who was a philosopher in space philosopher, and he developed Kantilism, which is a philosophy that we should leave Earth because Earth is sacred, and we should leave Earth and let it regenerate to its natural state. So it's sort of like primitivism without humans even being on Earth. But then the other part is Sidism, which is we should move into space colonies, and these space colonies should be independent from the Earth government that exists in the series. And there's one more part, which is new type theory, which is basically the Übermensch idea. So the idea that there's going to be like superhumans that come out of evolution, and they would eventually develop a sixth sense to mentally communicate with one another. And if
Gundam's to be believed, they're going to be child soldiers.
Yes, they're going to be child soldiers, exactly. So this philosophy resulted in like a space nation, essentially, in one of the colonies called the Republic of Zeon, which was quickly taken over by, you know, space Trump, essentially. You know, he filled the government with his children and declared himself Duke, or I don't remember, Sovereign. Yeah, so he's the king of the space station, and they turn into space Nazis. But what I think is an interesting ethical point is once Zeon Zum Daikun creates the Republic of Zeon, and they declare themselves independent from Earth. The Earth Federation responds with a policy of just withholding resources from them. So they're basically starving them until they come back to the mother country. And
it's kind of sounds like resistance is futile.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's an interesting question of, you know, if we do establish a space colony and they rebel against us, do we still owe it to them to send them the resources they need to survive?
Well, I think this is why I was saying that it's important to have this dialogue before we ever decide to go into space. Mm-hmm. Because if we don't move out of Earth as a unified front with a peaceful and positive and collective and cooperative take on our future plans, we're unlikely to survive. The long-term plans, as we can see in almost every science fiction, utopian and dystopian attempt at looking at the future, it always ends up with conflict if there hasn't been a united front going into it. Mm-hmm. You know, Star Wars, you've got your separatists. Star Trek shows pretty much the same thing. You've got elements within the Federation that are unhappy about the methods used by the Federation, and it ends up as a problem. The book I was talking about, one of the things that I don't... It's called Bio of the Space Tyrant, mm-hmm. the series, because he declares himself tyrant. After being a refugee and then going through the military, he then leaves the military where he's fought space pirates and he's won, and he's very popular among the Hispanic population, which has taken over most of Jupiter, and he ends up running for president after a few years in the Jupiter Senate and Congress and whatnot, and he runs for president and he wins, and one of his first acts is to call a constitutional convention, and at the constitutional convention he changes the constitution such that he can be named the tyrant of Jupiter. And as part of his tyranny, he basically legalizes drugs, then nationalizes the drug industry so that Jupiter then has a program similar to what the Dutch are doing, where they provide
space high quality
but basically they provide this system of providing cheap, high quality drugs that the people will then prefer, and in this way they manage to start programs that wean people off drugs. Eventually they win their drug war that way, instead of, you know, the way the US is currently doing it. They stamp out crime, they stamp out corruption, and in essence, although he's one of the most hated figures in the solar system, this man single-handedly fixes the political and economic problems facing Jupiter. It's probably one of the reasons why I was so into it, is the prospect of a single man making that much difference. But it brings up the question of, if one person has the answer to the entire solar system's problems, and some of the methods by which he achieves the solar system-wide peace are unethical, do we fight against that? Do we cast him out? I mean, if in the series, if it wasn't for him, Saturn and Jupiter would have absolutely annihilated each other in a missile crisis. If it wasn't for him, they wouldn't have discovered travel by light speed, which then enables the human race to not just colonize the solar system, but the rest of the galaxy. And in so doing, spreads humanity so far that we're able to forego any kind of conflict over resources, conflict over ideology, because literally, you don't agree with me? Well, go to another planet. No one cares. Go to another solar system.
So
no one cares.
Ultimate free association.
That's it. Ultimate free association through colonization. And these are the kinds of subjects that I think need to be discussed. And not just by a man on the street, you and me, small fries, grassroots level people, but also up at the top echelons of society. And unfortunately, I don't think it's going to happen. Not with the conflicts of interest that we see. Mm-hmm.
So here's my take. Okay, so first of all, I'm against tyranny. I think tyranny's bad. But I think space tyranny, probably a little bit okay. Anything is better in space.
Everything is better in space. And that's for... I was going to do the whole ad again.
if you have tyrants on Earth, bring them up into space. We'll shoot them with space lasers. Bam, got yourself a space tyrant.
And everything is better when you put the word space in front of it.
very important opinion that I have on that subject is, you know, I'm sympathetic to both consequentialist ethics and virtue ethics. I think they both have their place. And I think it's probably bad to be a tyrant and do, like, false flags and stuff and, like, you know, whatever. I didn't read the book, so I don't know exactly all the stuff he did. But I guess if it's between that and everyone killing each other, space tyranny seems a little bit better to me.
Yeah. No, and this is the beauty of that book. For anyone that goes on from this podcast to read the books, there's some very controversial bits in there. He talks about in one of the books, in the space pirate culture, the way marriage works is that there's rape involved. And it's actually something that is demanded by the woman space pirates. The way they reckon is that a man that is incapable of raping them is not worthy of them. So on the night of their wedding...
Okay.
It's totally messed up. But the way that they do it is on the night of the wedding, the woman is on her ship with a knife in her bedroom under her pillow. And the prospective husband has to sneak aboard the ship, and he has to sneak into her room, and he has to try and rape her, and she has to try and defend herself and kill him. And if she, one way or another, it works out the way they want it to. It's really messed up, and I had a lot of problems getting through those parts of the book. But
yeah, it sounds like something that an incel would write.
Yeah, no, and basically, he takes on very counterintuitive solutions to problems. Another big difference between the U.S. and the Jupiter Society is that in the Jupiter military, they have this institution called the tail. You know, whereas fraternization in the U.S. military is discouraged, in the Jupiter military, it's required. Once a week, you have to go get your groove on with some other enlisted or officer or whatever. And the whole idea being that that's how they root out homosexuality. So, yeah, another very controversial... he got a lot of flack for that one when the books were released.
Take notes, Kadyrov.
So, yeah, while I don't hold the books as these pillars of brilliance or whatever, they do have some very interesting and novel solutions and discussions, ethical as well as technical, about the colonization of space. But they also have a lot of issues that I don't necessarily agree with or particularly like.
I mean, if you agree with everything in a book, it's not really that interesting.
Yeah, it's not a very good book at that point. Except, of course, everything written by Grandpa Bookchin.
Yes. I agree with 100% of what he wrote. Google him.
Everything. Yeah, Google Grandpa Bookchin. Everyone right now that's listening to the show. Okay.
All right. So everything we said is right.
Every single word of what we just said is 100% true, researched and backed by NASA and all the other international space agencies.
Yes, proven by both empirical evidence and a priori reasoning, which, as we know, is the only truly correct way to prove any fact. A priori reasoning.
Never question your axioms.
Never critique pure reason.
Okay, thanks everyone. Just a reminder that caring about the world is too important for it to be a thing that only liars and mean jokes do.
Alright, see you next time.